Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast, and we're joined this week by Deborah Jones, who's here visiting from England. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Tim.
Now, Deborah has a new book out called The School of Compassion, A Roman Catholic Theology of Animals, which has been published in the UK. And what's the name of the publisher?
In the UK, it's Gracewing, and it's distributed in the USA by Liturgical Training Publications of Chicago, LTP.
LTP, okay. And you can look that up on Amazon.com. But maybe we can just begin by giving us a sense of what was the genesis of this project.
The genesis was in an academic master's degree, which I did about 12 years ago. And I had the opportunity to do a dissertation on animal theology with my tutor as the Reverend Professor Andrew Lindsay, who is the world pioneer in the subject of animal theology. So I was very fortunate there. And he was very helpful for the master's and encouraged me to make it into a doctoral. And after that, I was encouraged again to put it into a more readable version in a book, and that's how the book came about.
Most Catholics, maybe at least in this country, probably not aware that there is kind of a theology of animals, as you put it. Maybe you can kind of provide an introduction how you went about constructing this.
Well, I looked, first of all, at the four paragraphs in the Catechism and found, to my sadness, that there was a lot of inconsistency and internal contradictions within those four paragraphs. But there was one really superb sentence, which is that animals are God's creatures. By their mere existence, they bless him and give him glory. Thus men owe them kindness. And I thought that was such a splendid basis for a theology of animals, that they are not ours, we don't make them, we have no claim on them. They are entirely God's, and their purpose in creation is to give God glory.
Now, when you started your research, obviously you're going to look to the Bible, you're going to look to the tradition. What did you find that surprised you?
I was surprised by the degree of fear, I think, that the Church has had through the centuries of the association of animal welfare and vegetarianism with paganism. That so many of the early churches, or at the time of the early church, the vegetarian-based sects were pagan. They believed in transmigration of souls and things like that. So in order to counter that, the Church was quite opposed to the thinking in those groups. But at the same time as that negativity, there was the positive strand of the Desert Fathers and the Celtic saints, and then, of course, St. Francis of Assisi, who produced a different take on the animal creation, a far more inclusive attitude to creation and to the animal creation within that. So I was quite surprised by the degree of contrast between the negative strand and the positive strand that's been right through the tradition.
Well, maybe you can talk about the Desert Fathers to take an example, because I think St. Francis is somebody most of our listeners would be familiar with, but the Desert Fathers maybe less so.
Well, the Desert Fathers lived very frugal lives. They were leaving the decadence of the cities, and they wanted to live very close lives, very close to God. And one way of doing that was to live in harmony with creation, in the way that Christ had lived in the wilderness for 40 days with the wild beasts. And one of the ways that their holiness was recorded by the early church was in the friendly relationships that the wild animals had with the Desert Fathers. So, for example, when St. Paul the Hermit died, he couldn't be buried because the ground was so hard. So a couple of his lion friends came and scrubbed away at the ground until a hole was built, or dug, and his body was put in it, and then they put the sand back, and then they lay on it and wept for a time, and things like that. And stories about the martyrs being thrown to the lions, but the lions recognising their holiness and leaping on their shoulders and licking their faces and then bowing down before them and worshipping and things like that, which is really the early church's way of saying holiness and a oneness with creation are all of a piece. And it's that holiness which is a reconstruction, if you like, of the Garden of Eden. It's before the fall. It was the intention of God for the way human beings should live with the rest of nature. And it's the vegetarian diet, for example, when they were given only herbs to eat, and so were the animals, so that there was a peaceable kingdom. And it's that peaceable kingdom that the Desert Fathers were recreating in their own lives. And it's that that the prophet Isaiah was looking for the end of time, that the kingdom of God in the fullness will be similar to that. It'll be a sort of reconstruction of Eden, where all will be in harmony, wild beasts and people and nature reconstructed as it was intended by God.
Now, you mentioned vegetarianism. Were there, you know, members of the early church who did not eat meat?
All the Desert Fathers, all the Celtic saints, meat was considered both disrupting the harmony between man and beast, but also it was part of the violence that they were trying to leave behind, trying to abjure. And they also thought it sort of inflamed lustful passions and things like that. And so they abstained. And I think the whole church's history of abstinence was part of that. It's part of self-control, because it inflamed lustful thoughts and so on, which is pretty much the market that the publicists for the meat try to exploit today, that red meat for red-blooded males, that kind of thing. So it's still around. But yes, they were vegetarians, and a lot of religious orders still are, because they want to live frugally, they want to live healthily, and they want to live in harmony and not be part of the violence that all meat eating is inevitably a result of.
So we're looking at the Desert Fathers, which is obviously a long time ago, several hundred years, and looking at today, when there is more of a movement towards vegetarianism, what happened in the interim period? You know, in the church seemed to move away from that.
It just didn't seem to be an issue in the church. But then meat eating wasn't really an issue for much of the church, because most people couldn't afford it. So for centuries, meat eating was something that was restricted just to the few wealthy, the nobles and so on. So it wasn't considered to be an essential element in Christianity. The ordinary people and the ordinary priests wouldn't have had much meat anyway. So they saved it for feast days, for the major celebrations of Christmas and Easter and so on.
Now, when we look back to the Gospels, are there some examples there we can point to where we see Jesus treating animals in a certain way?
There's actually very little in the New Testament about animals. There's Jesus' record of saying that even the sparrow that falls in the sky is noted by God. But there's not a lot. He says that we should look at the birds of the air and see how they don't worry about the morrow, and we should have trust in our Creator as they have in theirs. But to be really concerned about animals, there has to be a certain standard of living in a culture. Beyond that, the human condition is usually so fraught that people face such hardship, such poverty and starvation, that they don't have the luxury, if you like, to think about the condition of animals in the most part, although there are marvellous records of saints who have done. So it's something that has only really come about in the last 100, 150 years. And it started, I think, really where the Industrial Revolution started. So it started in the British Isles and northwest Europe. And it's still pretty thin in Southeast Europe and Mediterranean and in other cultures. But I think as standards of living rise in other cultures, then so does an awareness of our proper treatment of other creatures.
Well, I guess one of the fundamental questions here is, you know, what is, you know, if we want to get into deep theological talk, you know, what is the status as a moral being of an animal versus a human? I mean, to talk about souls, for example, is that language used in the church tradition?
Yes, in the sense that God breathed his life-giving breath into the creatures in Genesis chapter 1. And the words in Hebrew, chai nefesh, mean living soul, that the life of an animal is something which has been given by God in just the same way that the life is given to a human being, inbreathed, the Spirit of God inbreathed into the creature to give it life. So yes, animals and souls and human souls, they're not separated as was thought in the medieval period by reason. That's not a consideration between animal and human souls, as we learn more and more about the reasoning capacity of animals. So it's something that the early church was able to pick up on much more easily, but with Greek philosophy, with its great emphasis on rationality, that it got somewhat suppressed.
Now that leads me to the next question, which is kind of two-part, but what has the scientific developments over the last, say, 50 years into, you know, study of animals, how did that kind of support your research and kind of help, I guess, push forward a theology of animals?
Yes, it's a rather ambivalent history, just as we've found throughout the whole church's history, that science has been very enlightening in letting us know how animals work, that their brains, their nervous systems, their behaviour patterns, and so on. So the more we learn about animals, the more we realise that they are complex individuals with their own idea of selfhood and life and so on. So that's the positive. But on the other side, science has also provided us with an attitude of animals as objects. Animals are something to be studied, in Descartes' terms, something just as machines, that you can overlook their feelings and their rights and do what you like with them. So factory farming and experiments on animals come from a sort of scientific mentality towards an instrumentalization of animals.
Now, if you look, I mean, this country at least, and I'm sure it's probably pretty similar in the United Kingdom, but a lot of the prominent voices for animal rights, to take Peter Singer as an example, is somebody who's very much not a a believer, people who are definitely secularists. But what can, do you think, a theology or what can the Catholic tradition bring to kind of the animal rights movement that it might be lacking, for example, in the work of Peter Singer?
Well, Peter Singer's attention to the rights of animals is quite a helpful thing. Only as a secularist, he goes beyond what we would accept as reasonable, because we do believe that there is a hierarchy in which people are the most responsible species. So that does give us an edge. It gives us an edge in terms of the power we have, but also in terms of the responsibility that we have to exercise. But in terms of the use of the word rights, Cardinal Heenan of Westminster in 1970 wrote a foreword to one of the books published by the organisation I work for, Catholic Concern for Animals, in which he says that we shouldn't talk about animal rights, we should talk about God's rights, that God has the right to have his creation not abused. And he said if you say casually that animals have no rights, then it can lead to a very callous and cruel attitude towards animals. So he won't have it. He says, no, we must always think that it's God's rights that we are protecting when we are concerned for animals. So I think that's a Catholic view that can be used in secularist terms. It's also one that's picked up by Andrew Lindsay, and he calls it theo-rights or theos rights, the rights that God has over his creation. And even a cardinal, whose name I can't remember, in the 19th century, said much the same thing. So it is within Catholic tradition to hold that view.
I think that's important to note, is that somebody like Peter Singer, utilitarian, puts humans and animals pretty much on the same level, whereas there is this hierarchy that exists within the Catholic tradition, that we should respect these animals, but perhaps, at least in the tradition, humans occupy a special place.
They do indeed occupy a special place, but what I would be very careful about is seeing the sense that we have a special place as not being seen as the sense in which we have an exploitative place, that as Christians we go against the culture which says those with power have rights over those without. We say, no, those without have rights over those with power, so that we who are powerful have duties towards the powerless, and we as followers of the servant king should imitate his sense of service, and we should therefore serve the needs of animals and not see animals as serving our needs.
You mentioned the group that you're involved in England, the Catholic Concern for Animals, correct?
Yes.
Maybe you can talk more about that.
Well, it was founded in 1929, by a group of people who were concerned, particularly at that time, about Spanish bullfighting, something which, unfortunately, is still marring the Catholic Church in Spain. And they decided to meet and pray and study and look at tradition and be concerned with animals. And they wanted the Archbishop at the time, Cardinal Bourne, to give them his blessing, which he did very readily. And he said, but I think when it comes to hands-on concern for animals, or I want you to get involved in the structures that already exist, things like the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And immediately, members of the board for Catholic Concern for Animals were co-opted onto the board of the RSPCA. So there was that strong link. And in the meantime, the Catholic Concern for Animals has been doing precisely what it was set out to do. It helps people with animal blessing services, provides materials, provides a journal three times a year called the ARC, to which anybody is entitled to receive a free copy. Just ask, just look at our website and follow the trails and ask us for free copies of the ARC. And we have members in 52 countries. We've got a new chapter in the States. It started about 3.5 years ago, and it's run by a lady in New Jersey who is very concerned to help bring the concerns of animals into the consciousness of the church here in the States. And I particularly hope that it can get into the academic sphere, that it should be on the syllabus, the curriculum of schools, seminaries, and theological institutions. And then the next generation, I hope, will not be working under the ideas that some of our older people do, that animals are just resources, just something put here for us to treat as we want for profit and for whatever other exploitative reasons we can find for them.
Well, you mentioned the Academy, and I understand you just came from speaking at the Catholic Theological Society of America. How is generally the Academy received this, your work and kind of animal rights work in general?
Well, in this country, it's very much a frontier land for that subject. It's a rather small group from within that vast body of the Catholic Theological Society of America that was interested in animals. I think in the UK, it is more prevalent, and schools teach concerns about animals, and it's on the syllabus of very many more institutions than I think is the case here, unfortunately. But I'm hoping that by having gone and networked and talked to quite a lot of people, that it may make some difference and that something might happen in the future. I sincerely hope so.
Well, maybe we can end by just talking about what are some concrete things, somebody who perhaps isn't a theologian, but is share some of your concerns. What can a Catholic do on a practical level to, you know, show more concern and compassion for animals?
One of the things they could do is to pray for animals, and if they are liturgically gifted, perhaps they might devise little rituals and services for comfort and counselling for comfort of people who lose their cherished pets. It's something that concerns a great number of people, both here in the USA and in the UK, and the church really has nothing to offer for those people who suffer from the loss of a pet. So they could perhaps help in that way. They could perhaps help with supporting poor people who can't support their own animals when they get sick. They can't support veterinary fees and things. There are people who need to look after each other's pets when they go on vacation or when they retire and have to move into a smaller home or something. So there are sorts of practical things that people could do at a local level. And then in church, perhaps they could ask for bidding prayers, the prayers of intercession, to include the animal creation from time to time. And in their consumer choices, if they would choose humanely, wherever possible, organically produced, free range, and best of all, not meat-based, if possible. And in all other respects, to just encourage an atmosphere in the home and in the school and in the neighbourhood of concern for animals, because animals are indeed worthy of concern as they are loved by God.
Well, the book again is The School of Compassion, A Roman Catholic Theology of Animals. It's available on Amazon.com. It's liturgical training publications. And we want to thank Deborah Jones for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. I encourage you to look online this week, where we have a review of the play The Pittman Painters from Karen Sue Smith. We also have a reflection for Thanksgiving, a video reflection from Father Jim Martin. A reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.